This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. World AIDS Day is today, in case you didn't know that. It has been over 30 years since the disease was first documented in the United States. The first official CDC report about the AIDS epidemic came out in June of 1981. How I remember that. And those initial cases were in gay white men in big cities like New York and San Francisco. And since that time, new treatments, funding, and interventions have decreased the overall rate of new infections. But the latest CDC report shows that the highest concentration of HIV cases has shifted. Almost half of the people living with HIV reside in the South. And the hardest hit are African-American, gay, and bisexual men. The causes are a mix of complicated factors dealing with funding, access to health care, and stigma that still exists about the disease. One city in particular that has been hard hit is Jackson, Mississippi. My next guests are here to help us delve into the details of what is happening in Jackson and across the American South. Linda Villarosa is a journalist and director of the journalism program at the City College of New York. She has written about the epidemic in Jackson. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much.
Leonardo Mena is a director of the Center for HIV/AIDS Research, Education, and Policy at the University of Mississippi Medical Center, and he's a clinician working in Jackson. Welcome, Dr. Mena, for taking time to be with us today. Thanks to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Linda, you've been covering AIDS and HIV almost since the beginning. Can you give us a brief trace of the disease, how it's become so concentrated in these communities in the South?
Well, what comes to mind is left behind. And so part of it is because so much of the attention was focused, like you were saying, in the North or in big cities and on white gay male populations. And so for various reasons and over a long period of time, the disease has just gotten more concentrated in the South and really in black, gay, and bisexual men.
Leandra, you've worked as a clinician in Jackson for 15 years. Tell us how you have seen the patterns of the disease change.
I think, over the last, 15 years, we have gone through a process, that has given us, a better understanding of the HIV epidemic that is affecting, our region. Jackson, Mississippi is a state that has a relatively small population of 3 million people. Jackson is a moderate-sized city, but it's very representative of what's happening in many of the cities, in many of the southern states that have, very similar kind of cultural, and social context. And I think, what we have learned is that we have gone from not knowing and not speaking about what we have to recognizing, the challenges that we have ahead of us and how the number of HIV cases are increasing at a staggering, rate, and how in an incredible way, an incredible time that we're living, that you can argue that we have, science has given us, the tools to end the HIV epidemic. In many places in the South, we continue to see how those advances, have not really reached the population who is at risk.
Well, let's talk about it. Linda, why are they not getting what other people are getting?
Well, first, hi, Dr. Mena, and I love the work he's doing. And, we must say this, that on the ground, there are a lot of people who really care about this issue and who are working very hard. But some of it is just, has to do with transportation. Some of it has to do with other kind of...
Well, let's talk about it. For example, transportation.
So what I noticed was people had trouble getting around if they did not have a car. So in New York City, where we are, there's a, wonderful subway system and buses. But in Jackson, the buses are really bad. It takes an hour. You might have to wait for a bus an hour and then another bus, another hour to get back. And so I noticed that transportation was a big thing. Also, many of the infrastructures are just really not that good. And so some of the clinics are not as good, not as strong as they should be. They don't have all of the latest, equipment and things like that. But I think the infrastructure thing really struck me. the amount of money. You saw a lot of people who were very poor. So if you are poor, you're not as worried about HIV and even your own health because you're worried about survival. And I did see a lot of that where people were thinking first about, you know, how am I going to eat? How am I going to take care of myself? Not exactly how am I going to prevent HIV, which if I know about it.
Mm. Dr. Mena, if people do come to you, do you have the resources to treat them and help them?
I do. I mean, but again, you know, to a certain extent, you know, and as bad, you know, I think, you know, as better as things, you know, that could, things could be, and services that we provide, you know, in the city of Jackson could be. People who live in this metropolitan area of Jackson is somehow privileged. I mean, we have the University of Mississippi Medical Center that cares for approximately 30%, 40% of people who are HIV infected who are in care. But 55%, like Linda said, of the population in the city of Jackson, you know, live in rural areas. And for those individuals who are HIV infected, who live in rural areas, who don't have reliable transportation, getting access, you know, to quality care is quite a challenge. Not to mention that very often the only care that may be available to them sometimes may be, you know, in places where they may not necessarily feel comfortable in terms of their protection of their privacy, you know, because people who they know may work there. So that presents, you know, challenges. In terms of access, you know, to care, we, again, in the Jackson area, I mean, there are, you know, a number of providers that provide, you know, I think, you know, a state-of-the-art, you know, care for HIV, but in many of the rural areas, even access to HIV testing is fairly precarious.
Hmm. So I guess, Linda, when you said, for example, people don't take the bus. It's a too long a bus ride. But from what I hear about the privacy issue, they're fearful of asking for a ride because of the stigma involved.
I remember there was a guy I was interviewing, and he was at a smaller city, maybe 2 hours east of Jackson. And so he was very ill by the time he found out he was HIV positive. And I said, you know, why didn't you know? Why didn't you get tested? And he said, I was afraid to go to the local hospital to get tested, which I knew they offered testing, because my aunt worked there. Everybody knows my grandmother there. Everybody knows my mother there. And so I didn't want to go there. And that is a common problem.
But is that because it's a small town?
It was a small town.
But being in the South, does that add additional stressors also?
Yes, because the stigma is just higher there. It just is. And, you know, at once where you have people who are open and you have people who are loving and you have people who are really doing a lot of work in this area, you have other people who are just, they have high stigma against LGBT people, and it's very hard for them to talk about that. There's the church that makes it difficult. A lot of the guys I interviewed, I said, does the church, I know you grew up in the church, does the church give you some kind of solace? And they said, no, it's the opposite. The church is actually hostile. I've stopped going.
Wow. So there.
So if I can add, I think, you know, the stigma ties up, you know, in poverty, because the issue, you know, and the challenge is that many of these individuals who are, you know, at risk of HIV or who are infected with HIV, who, you know, live, you know, in poverty, are, you know, vulnerable, more vulnerable than other populations may be, you know, to a stigma. So they depend, you know, on their families. They depend on very often on the support of families and friends in order to just get by. And they are, you know, afraid of of how this support may be jeopardized by, you know, people learning they either, you know, that they either are HIV infected or that they may be, you know, gay.
Mm-hmm. I interviewed someone who was a college student. He had been a college student. But then when he came out to his family, they said, leave. And so he ended up in a homeless shelter, HIV positive in a homeless shelter. And so, like you're saying, Dr. Mena, it's like part of it is you're living already just close to the bone. And so then if you lose the support of your family because they don't accept who you are, that makes you vulnerable to all kinds of health problems and issues, including HIV.
I know there's an idea that the rate of infection has something to do with having a lot of partners. Dr. Mena, but it has to do with the prevalence of the virus in this community, right? The high level of virus here.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of work has been done. Certainly, we know that a lot of work has been done trying to explain, you know, why the disparities in the HIV infection rates between, you know, African Americans and whites. And one thing that has been proven is that a difference in behavior don't explain these changes. When you compare white men who are with men and black men who are with men, they, you know, even at similar behaviors, you know, that doesn't necessarily explain why blacks are much more likely to be infected with HIV than whites. And what seemed to explain, and I think, you know, Linda mentioned that at the very beginning, are things that have more to do with access to health services, with the background prevalence of HIV that may exist in the African-American, you know, a gay community. So even if you have only one partner or two partners, which, you know, by all, you know, people would argue that that's not really having too many partners, the chances that that person may be, that one partner may be positive, is much more higher in networks of African-American men who are with men than what it may be in other sexual networks. So behavior really doesn't necessarily, you know, explain these disparities. Access to, you know, health insurance and to health services, so people can get tested for HIV or receive treatment for HIV, is a more important reason.
So let's talk about solutions. What's the solution or a solution here?
I think one of the solutions is really to support the people on the ground that are doing the work. And by support, I'm just going to, it's money. And so, there always needs to be more money. There needs to be more technical assistance.
Where would the money come from?
The money should come from our government, which is, I know, a ridiculous thing to say right now. But the money can also come from pharmaceutical companies. The money can come from nonprofit organizations. There just needs to be more money and support and technical support. But I think that one thing I learned from having spent time there is we also have to give acceptance and love and to say we understand what's going on. It's hard. We're not judging you. We're just trying to see what can we do? How can we assist you, aid you, lend what we have, give what we have to you?
Dr. Mena, let me talk about the money for just a bit with you. The South does not receive as much funding for HIV and AIDS as other parts of the country, considering how many people are living with the disease in that area. And why is that? And is it possible to change that?
Yes. I mean, I think it is possible, and you're correct. I mean, part of it, you know, a lot of the care of HIV is funded through the federal government, thanks to the Ryan White Care Act. That Congress, you know, reauthorizes every 5 years and provides, you know, care for, is a payer of life resource for the care of HIV. It cares probably for almost half of individuals who are HIV infected in the United States. And what happened is that the formula, you know, that is used for allocation of HIV resources takes in consideration the total number of cases of HIV. So if you think about that, that includes a lot of individuals who may no longer be living with HIV or be living anymore. So that the formula is skewed towards, you know, cities or states like New York City or California or some of the larger cities in California and the Midwest, affects, you know, negatively impacts the smaller cities in the South that have a much more kind of a, if you will, younger epidemic. But I think the urgency and the needs of the South are being recognized. I think that, as I say, you know, at the beginning, you know, luckily we have the tools to really end the HIV epidemic. What we need is the investment to make sure that these tools reach the population that are in the greatest needs. And if we don't figure it out as a community, I think the challenge that we have is that, you know, in few years, I mean, HIV can become mainly a problem of the South.
This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. That's interesting that you say that. It just would be isolated as mostly in the South, is what you're saying, Dr. Mena.
Right.
Well, so it would be known as a problem in the South. Now, I know that you at the University of Mississippi Medical Center run an LGBT clinic, a successful one, I'm assuming. Are there lessons you can learn from that experience?
Well, certainly. You know, we don't run the clinic at the University of Mississippi. The clinic is actually run by a community-based organization, My Brother's Keeper, which is a community-based organization with whom we partner to build this clinic. And primarily is because we wanted to create a space where the community, you know, felt welcome, you know, felt included, where people, you know, didn't feel, you know, judged by, you know, who they were or, you know, the choices, you know, or who they were, you know, as individuals, or infections that they had, or where they seek, you know, prevention or treatment of these things. So, I think, you know, that clinic opened its doors in February 2013, and since then, what we have seen is an incredible, you know, increasing awareness among healthcare providers and healthcare systems, both in our city, in our state, and even in our region, of the need to build, you know, healthcare, you know, systems that are culturally competent, who are capable of delivering quality care for gender and sexual minorities that are affected by so many health disparities, including HIV, you know, and sexually transmitted infections.
So the conversation has begun in larger communities.
I agree.
Yeah.
And I also like My Brother's Keeper isn't just about HIV/AIDS. It's about healthcare disparities, and it's about all kinds of healthcare. So when you go there, you don't necessarily, I mean, people in the know it's an HIV/AIDS clinic or an LGBT clinic, but there are other people getting treated for other things there. And so it feels more community and less very specific about this one disease.
Well, we've run out of time. I'd like to thank both of my guests, Linda Villarosa, journalist and director of the journalism program at the City College of New York. Leandro Mena is director of the Center for HIV/AIDS Research, Education, and Policy at the University of Mississippi Medical Center and a clinician working in Jackson. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.